Hello and welcome to Volume 44 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll discuss the favorable vote by the U.S. Senate, which provides some much-needed tax relief for forest owners. We'll highlight the economic benefit that forests provide to cities, such as providing clean water and clean air, and how these monetary benefits have now been valued. And we'll talk about what to do when your forests have been damaged by natural disasters, such as Hurricane Ivan. I'm Hayes Brown, the General Counsel for the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. A past president of the AFOA, Henry Barclay, called it the most significant timber tax legislation for non-industrial private landowners in our lifetimes. And those that follow forest tax policy will tell you that our next guest is largely responsible for the recent vote that has been made by the U.S. Senate that will be possible, has made it possible for forest owners to qualify for capital gains treatment. With hearty congratulations, Capital Ideas Live welcomes Bill Siegel. Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Hayes.
Do you agree with Henry it's a significant vote?
Absolutely. I think it was the most significant provision ever passed with respect to timber taxation.
Why do you say that? What was at stake?
Well, at stake were several things, Henry, and we're talking about Section 631B, which a timber tax owner, a non-industrial landowner, has to follow with respect to timber stumpage sales in order to assure himself or herself of capital gain treatment. And what we're talking about here basically is a pay-as-cut contract, which has many disadvantages. And many forest landowners in Alabama and across the South and across the country have had to use Section 631B, a pay-as-cut contract, in order to assure themselves of capital gains. They could not use a lump sum sale or a timber deed, which is much more advantageous in many cases. And this legislation has revised Section 631B to permit a timber owner under all circumstances, all timber owners, to use a lump sum sale now and be assured of qualifying for capital gains.
What's it? Is there a significant difference in the taxes paid under capital gains as opposed to whatever the other rate might
be? Absolutely.
The
individual capital gain rate today is 15%, and in fact even 10% or 5% for some low-income landowners. But the highest non-capital gain rate, the ordinary rate, is 35%. And in addition, if a landowner does not qualify for capital gains treatment, they may also be subject to the self-employment tax, which is an additional 15%.
Okay, that is a significant gap between those two methods of taxing. Tell me this, do you have to be consistent in using these two type contracts you mentioned, or can you switch back and forth as you wish?
No, you can switch back and forth. The new legislation permits a landowner to sell either under a pay-as-cut contract or a lump-sum sale contract, and to switch back and forth. It does not have to be consistent. And an important point here is if a landlord does choose to use a pay-as-cut contract to continue using one, if he or she wants to, they still can.
Okay. A lot of flexibility there.
A lot of flexibility, yes.
What about reforestation costs? Did they deal with that at all?
Yes. Another significant provision in the new Tax Act deals with reforestation. Currently, reforestation expenses to a maximum of $10,000 per year may be amortized over the following 8 years. And in addition, there's a 10% tax credit, limited again to a maximum of $10,000 per year. The new legislation now permits the first $10,000 annually of reforestation expenses to be outright expensed, outright deducted. In the year that it occurs. And the remainder, no ceiling, can be amortized over 84 months. And just to give you an example, if a landowner incurred $30,000 of reforestation expenses in a particular year, the first $10,000 could be written off immediately, and the remaining $20,000 recovered over 8 tax years.
Okay. Well, that's a double whammy then.
Another point is that the 10% tax credit has been eliminated. But for most landowners, most taxpayers, the new provisions would be more advantageous.
What type of forest landowner is most affected by this sort of thing? What's the profile of someone who really sees some real benefits to this?
Well, corporations, if you want to be honest about it, because there's no ceiling on the amount that can be amortized after that first $10,000 is expensed. But it's advantageous for all forest landowners.
Particularly those that sell frequently, whether they're corporations or not?
Yes, sure. And if they sell frequently and then reforest, absolutely, yes.
Okay. Well, thanks, Bill. We appreciate you joining us. Thanks for sharing that with us. We've often encouraged forest owners to view what they do with pride and even recognize that forests provide benefits to society that society doesn't pay for. But we've never been able to quantify the economic value to society of forests until now. A study created by the Jefferson County Stormwater Management Authority has calculated these economic benefits of forests to the area, and we've invited its Assistant Director, Steve McKinney, to be with us. Welcome, Steve.
Thanks, Hayes. Good morning.
Tell us about this study, the study that the Stormwater Management Authority just performed and what it was supposed to accomplish.
Well, the study was based off of a $200,000 grant from the U.S. Forestry Service, and it really began with a pretty broad but simple question, and that was, how can we educate public officials and the public about the value of the components of the environment? So we took a little bit different approach in doing that. Typically, what we look at is we look at the resource value or the product value, in mm-hmm. particular in association with forestry.
In this case, the trees themselves?
Correct. Mm-hmm. And what products can we receive from those? So what we wanted to do that was a little bit different is look at the public service value that was being provided by our urban forest canopy and our rural forest canopy. So that was a little bit different approach.
Yes, it is. It's looking at a little more intangible benefit. What were the findings that the Stormwater Management Authority found?
Well, we'll use, for example, the city of Birmingham, and I can give you some total numbers on that for the entire study. The study was about a 1,400 square mile area in total. Okay. So it covered all of Jefferson County and portions of St. Clair and Shelby County within central Alabama. But for instance, Birmingham, a large metropolitan area, what we found was a total annual savings of about $29 million. That is based off of annual air pollution removal savings of about $12 million. And an annual stormwater savings of about $17 million if that was looked at over a 20-year period at 6% interest.
Okay. Now, over a larger period of time, one figure that we saw in the report was $248 million. Per
Correct. Year. That is for the total project area, that entire Birmingham metropolitan area. So it includes all of the rural and the metro cities around, and it's kind of a distributed area. So what you look at there is a total annual savings of about $248 million. If you looked at just the total stormwater value and looked at it over that total 20-year amortization, you would have about $1.5 billion in value.
Okay. Wow. Now, just to be clear on the area, and you're talking about every year.
Yes.
The $248 million figure.
Correct.
And to be clear on the area you're talking about, this is would include Birmingham and the parts of the heavily populated parts of Shelby County that are near Birmingham. Is that right?
Correct. We have an awful lot of development going on in the southeastern portion of our jurisdiction right now. So I'd be looking at Helena, Pelham, Hoover, those areas.
Okay. Well, comment just a moment about what difference it makes to the Stormwater Management Authority as to whether something is forested as opposed to other uses like open land or commercial or even residential homes. What's the difference?
Well, there's lots of potential value. One of the big things that we want to look at is exactly what the influence of, say, a medium-sized tree. Just look at it within the context of a single tree.
Okay.
We can intercept as much as potentially 2,300 gallons of water per year. And that makes a profound impact on how much water is running off of the land. The transport system for pollutants is going to be the rainfall runoff. So what we can see there is if we impede that progress, and the trees do a wonderful job of that, then that actually helps agencies like ours and different environmental regulatory agencies because there's less transfer of the pollutants to the streams, creeks, and rivers.
Okay. On a net basis, do forests contribute more to clean water than they contribute to pollution? I mean, how does it balance out?
Well, that's a tough question. And, is in a natural state, absolutely. Mm-hmm. There's very little that can be said that is in a negative context. There are some issues with trees that contribute some factors to ozone, and those are biogenic resources and things like that. But for the most part, yes, they definitely are positive.
And certainly for water quality.
And definitely for water quality.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Steve, thank you. I appreciate you joining us very much.
Thank you.
Recently, Hurricane Ivan reminded us how natural disasters can dismantle even the most carefully prepared forest management plan. Here to discuss the topic of natural disasters in a way that only a tax expert could is John Green. Hello, John.
Good morning, Hayes.
Could you comment about the number of natural disasters in the South this year? And I'm talking about, you know, ice storms or fires or hurricanes.
Well, I can't give you the exact number, but we know that there's been a lot of them in all parts of the South.
And from a tax standpoint, is there any good news to that sort of tragedy?
The only good news, Hayes, may be that there's a tax deduction for losses for everyone who holds timber to produce income, whether it's as an investment or as part of a trade or business.
Okay. There was a revenue ruling, I think they call it, back a few years ago. I think we talked about it on a prior program. Could you just go over how casualty losses are calculated and how the whole process works from a tax standpoint?
Okay. Hayes, that was Revenue Ruling 9956, which basically made calculating a casualty loss a three-step process. So the first step is determine your basis in the block that was affected by the disaster. And that just means the account that you use to keep track of your adjusted basis. So if you keep track of the adjusted basis of all your timber in one account, you use the total amount in that account.
Okay, you get your basis, and then what's the next step?
All right, the second step then is to determine the difference in the fair market value of the block immediately before and immediately after the loss. Now, for most owners, that's going to be the pre-disaster value of the affected timber, but you want to subtract out the value of any timber that's salvageable so you don't overstate your loss.
Okay, so you take the value before and value after, and then don't count the part that's actually still salvageable.
Right.
Okay, and then what?
Then all you do is compare the two figures, and your deduction's the smaller amount.
Okay, all right, that's how you calculate your loss. Well, some of these areas are declared by the president to be natural disaster areas. Is there any significance to that declaration?
Yes, there is. If you have a casualty loss resulting from a presidentially declared disaster, you can choose to deduct the loss either on an original or amended tax return for the year immediately before the loss that the disaster took place. So what that means is you don't have to wait up to a year before you can take this deduction.
You take it in the year before your loss, so you would amend your prior tax return if you've already filed?
Right. If you already filed one, you had to file an amended return. If you haven't filed one yet, and for example, if you had a disaster in the early spring of next year, you could, when you fill out your tax return for this year, you could take the loss deduction then.
Okay. And that's only in areas that are declared natural disasters by the president.
Right. Presidentially declared disasters.
Okay.
Also, the IRS can postpone some tax deadlines. For example, there's a link on the little section next to my picture to the IRS website that shows that owners in the 65 Alabama counties affected by Hurricane Ivan would generally have until December 30th to file tax returns and submit payments that were due after September 13th.
Okay, give you a bit of extension to pay those taxes.
Right.
Great. Well, thanks, John. We've also got a link to the revenue ruling that you mentioned there.
Appreciate
you joining us.
All right.
If Hurricane Ivan left you wishing you were better prepared for natural disasters, you may want to talk to our next guest, Ed Wilson, whose company, Davis Garvin, offers insurance protection for these type losses. Hello, Ed.
Hello, Hayes.
Does Davis Garvin offer insurance protection for the kind of losses that we've been talking about?
Yes, sir. We've had a insurance program for standing timber available for about 15 years. We actually rolled it out about a month before Hurricane Hugo, and our first two accounts were total losses.
Uh-oh. Well, you're still doing it, though, right?
Yes, sir.
What is the price structure for this type of loss?
The price is based on the value of the timber and the rate and the age of the timber, about 65 cents per $100 of value to 1.25 per $100 of value. So just roughly between a half percent to a little over a percent of the value of the trees.
Okay, so the rates vary depending on the value of the trees themselves. Do you have to cruise the timber before you submit an application to you guys?
I don't always need a firm cruise. A cruise is nice to have, but in terms of a lot of times we don't. And we use the value that was established at a sale value or things of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, how do you go about proving the loss if you've got it insured for a certain amount based on the value? Some of the timber is probably destroyed, and some of it may be salvageable. How do you break that out?
Well, the loss calculation is based on the loss minus the salvage value, minus the deductible. So mm-hmm. whatever salvage you can get. And what we learned in Hurricane Hugo and probably will learn in Ivan is that a lot of salvage value is not even obtainable.
It may be out there standing, or but getting someone to actually salvage it is a different story. What about cleanup cost as opposed to just the value of the timber that's gone? Is that sort of thing covered?
No, sir.
Okay, so that's a separate separate value that the landowner has.
That is correct.
Okay. Well, thanks, Ed. Appreciate
where the
you.
Hmm? Interest mainly in this has come over the years is sawmills and banks requiring a line of credit to be insured in a lot of private landowners also.
Right. It's particularly useful for lenders, as you discussed, and sawmills who have actually purchased that timber apart from the land itself underlying.
That is correct.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Ed.
Thank you.
Catherine Mader is our next guest. She's studied specifically forest owners who don't join organizations like this one. These are independent, self-sufficient people who find out information on their own. And we wanted to find out what she found out in her study, and so we've invited her to join us. Hello, Catherine.
Hello, Hayes. How are you?
What did you learn from interviewing private forest landowners? This is all across the United States, I think.
That's correct. We had a research project that was funded by the Wood Education Research Center back in 2002. And what we were allowed to do in the first phase of this research was to concentrate on interviews with what we call non-joiner, non-industrial private landowners, mostly in the eastern half of the United States that encompassed hardwood territory. And our rationale for engaging in this research was to really see if we had either good connections or disconnects in communication of how you reach landowners as they make decisions to fragment or convert their forest lands. So as a result, part of the research results in this phase one approach indicated to us that and there were about 200 interviews that we conducted with non-joiner private forest landowners in these regions in the eastern half of the United States. We knew that legislation was happening on the Hill, much in part thanks to people like Bill Siegel helping to really make lives easier for forest landowners in taxing areas.
Mm-hmm.
But our research actually showed that the non-joiner NIPF didn't feel they ever had a problem with taxes, including estate taxes, which was a big find for us in the process.
A big surprise, wasn't it? That wasn't a hot-button issue?
It wasn't. It didn't even hardly rank in terms of the areas of concern for them that would drive them to fragment or convert their forest lands. What we did find was the major driver out of all of this was, in fact, the lack of interest for their offspring to continue forest lands in family hands. And so as a result, what we thought were drivers going into this, like estate taxes, capital gains, a lot of issues that were on the docket back in Washington, D.C., were really misconnects to these landowners. And, in fact, encroaching development, taxation, all of these other things really became consequences of the primary driver of their offspring simply not thinking it's cool to own forest lands anymore.
So if I may call it just apathy, a general apathy about owning forest land was one of the drivers that results in land being sold to outside the family or to whomever. Is that a fair summary?
It is a fair summary, except to suggest that there was apathy involved with these offspring. We were interested in actually finding out if that was exactly the case. So we are now engaged in phase two of this research that is being funded by the U.S. Forest Service. It's the first of its kind in the United States, whereby we are actually interviewing the offspring of non-industrial private forest landowners to really find out what they are thinking and what their desires and wishes are and what actually would drive them to re-engage back in this process of maintaining forest lands in family hands.
Okay, so you've got another round of the study that is coming out later. What about the first round? When is it going to become available?
The first round is already available and completed. I believe that the research results will be on the website that will be a part of this program.
Okay, we'll look forward to hearing the rest of the story about the offspring of these non-joiner, non-industrial private landowners. We've got a new term to remember now.
That's correct.
All right. Well, thanks, Catherine. Appreciate you joining us.
Thank you.
Many foresters will tell you that a good aerial photograph is an invaluable piece of information in managing forests. But how can you get one? And better yet, how can you get one for free? DeWitt Broad from LSU can tell us how to do that. Hello, DeWitt.
Good morning, Hayes.
I just wanted to ask you first about what are the sources of low-cost or even free aerial photography that's out there?
Well, there are, in many states there are sources from certain state agencies and universities that can provide access to aerial photography and sometimes make copies for you at a low cost. But probably the best source in the U.S. for this is the United States Geological Survey, what we call the AROS Data Center, which is the Earth Resources Observation Systems Data Center that's located in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. They have a website and phone numbers and other ways that you can access them and get access to aerial photography and maps and other kinds of data. But they do provide a wide range of aerial photography that people can order at a relatively low cost and get access to it in various formats. So there's a very good source there.
Okay. Could you, you know, these are ones that you'd get for low cost, but I know that there are custom aerial photography that many people use. Could you compare and contrast these two sources and the benefits maybe of each set?
Well, what's going on right now is a huge transition in aerial photography to digital. And the transition is in two ways. The aerial photographs are being scanned on some high-quality scanners, and the influx now of digital cameras, just like there's a huge change in handheld digital cameras that we're all exposed to now. This is also true for aerial imagery. And the change is drastic in the sense that it's becoming it's revolutionizing the way we handle aerial photography and actually get it to people, where the digital formats allow us to deliver it online and on the web in ways that we couldn't do before. So it's a vast change there in the delivery mechanism and in the use of photography in that sense.
Okay, so if you use one of these lower cost photography, you're probably not going to have all the bells and whistles.
Well, it's certainly there's certainly going to be more limited access to it in the future because of the move toward digital, and people are really going to have to become a little more savvy on getting this on the web. But there are websites that make this very easy, and they are growing in popularity tremendously right now, and there are many ways that people can get access to it through their own state agencies that are beginning to deliver it, universities, and even the federal government. So it's going to revolutionize the way we're working with aerial photography.
Okay. Well, thanks, DeWitt. Appreciate you being with us. One of the more innovative programs sponsored by the Alabama Forestry Association is something called the Forestry Leadership Series. It's an intensive course that's now available to those who wish to be on the cutting edge of forestry issues. Chris Irwin can tell us about it. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Hayes.
What's the idea behind this course that's now being offered?
Well, you only have to go to a couple of conferences like the Forest Owners Annual Conference or our annual meeting, and anytime an issue like Amendment 1 comes up on the agenda, if you listen to the audience response, you hear it mumbled throughout that there's a leadership problem. And our members got together and decided they needed to put together a program that would help prepare tomorrow's leaders dealing with issues like forest certification or environmental interest groups or political action committees, even personal skills like dealing with the media or this program that I'm on right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's kind of helping to train the new leaders of tomorrow. What's the end goal? What types of things are covered by it, and you know, what kind of information you're trying to impart?
Okay, there's going to be six sessions throughout 2005 in Auburn, Montgomery, Mobile, Florence, Tuscaloosa, and Birmingham, and they're going to cover topics like your typical silviculture and manufacturing processes, but also present a lot of issues, environmental, land use issues, things like that, and there'll be a strong emphasis throughout all of those on getting involved in the political process and how it affects those issues.
Okay. Is this for foresters or who?
This is for landowners, children of landowners, loggers, foresters, anybody that's involved in the forestry community. There's an age range. We're looking for young professionals. There's also a tuition fee. I think it's going to cost $3,000, but that covers your room and board, covers transportation to all the field trips. It's going to begin on a Tuesday night. We'll have a short program session, guest speaker. Wednesday, they'll take field trips, go see places, and then Thursday, wrap up with some presentations.
Okay, a very intensive program, it looks like.
Yes, sir, it is.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks, Chris. Appreciate you highlighting that for us.
Okay. If they're interested, they need to get in touch with Rick Oates or myself here at the Forestry Association office, 334-265-8733.
Okay. And is there a deadline for this?
I think the end of October, October 31st.
Okay. All right. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Ace.
Our final guest has waited patiently for us to come to him. That's a skill he's perfected over the years as a wild turkey hunter. Brian Burns with the National Wild Turkey Federation is with us. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how are you?
I wanted to talk about prescribed burning today as it relates to turkey habitat. What are your views on that?
Well, prescribed fire is a wonderful tool for wild turkeys. When we look at, you know, how do I get more turkeys or deer or quail or other wildlife species on my line, on my land, the first thing is active forest management. Absolutely is the foundation of doing this. But one of the tools that is there to help a landowner is prescribed fire. It does a variety of things. You know, a turkey lives by what it can see. I mean, it survives in areas where it can see and watch out for danger, or it can get food such as green plants and insects. So what prescribed fire does is it reduces the amount of hardwood competition or mid-story hardwood, that thick, dense vegetation that can choke out a lot of that important ground layer of plants. So fire helps open up the forest. It really is a very inexpensive tool. You know, most landowners who may be not familiar or comfortable with prescribed fire, they can go to the Alabama Forestry Commission. They actually will do for a relatively low fee help with prescribed fire. So the opportunities are there. In Alabama, it is a very active forest state. They burn an estimated over 1 million acres a year.
Well, could you speak to those that haven't done burning and are really, frankly, a little bit afraid of burning, or they've been taught that that's bad? How can you work on those fears that people have about burning?
Absolutely. You know, and it is a common, there's still misconceptions. I know as a wildlife biologist, I've faced this from people in the general public who don't understand about fire and are either afraid of it or feel it's very damaging or hurts animals. First of all, there is training in place in Alabama to help a landowner become certified. Again, the Alabama Forestry Commission does have a course that a landowner can go through.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, the training fire is easy. Once you learn the fundamentals, it's a very easy and safe practice to do. But there is a law, there's Section 913.272A in the Alabama state law that does provide protection to landowners who have a written plan, who do follow state laws when they implement prescribed burning, and there must be a certified burner on right there on the burn. So there is some protection there. It is a safe, you know, there's no sure things. You're talking about, you don't control fire, and I don't like to use the word control fire. It's a prescribed fire. It's set under prescribed conditions to do prescribed objectives.
Real quickly, is it getting harder to find people to do burning these days?
It can be, and it depends regionally. You know, the biggest thing is it is a very easy task, or a reasonably easy task, for most landowners to do. And I recommend that landowners look at going ahead and getting certified, getting the training, and they can go to the Alabama Forestry Commission and get help when they can't do it themselves.
Okay. Thanks, Brian. Mm-hmm. Appreciate it. Well, that's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to Bill Siegel, John Green, and Ed Wilson. Thanks also to Catherine Mader, DeWitt Broad, Chris Irwin, and Brian Burns. We're also particularly pleased to have Steve McKinney from the Jefferson County Stormwater Management Authority. We've always suspected that forests provide more benefits than detriments when it comes to stormwater issues that cities face, $248 million per year in the Birmingham area alone, to be exact. This is also the time that Jefferson County forest owners receive their ad valorem tax bill, which includes a line item called a stormwater fee as part of the bill. The net effect is that forests give cities $248 million in benefits, yet cities charge a stormwater fee for the services they supply to the forests. Something seems a little out of balance here. If cities charge forests for services, maybe it's fair game that forests charge cities for the services they provide. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown, thanking you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.